Justice for All in a Changing America. That's the topic of an important conversation happening on the UNF campus. We'll tell you all about it in just a moment. And good morning, live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. First Coast Connect, always live on the radio, and now catch our daily podcast on iTunes. Just ahead, don't miss it. It's a conversation with Southern Poverty Law Center founder Morris Dees. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, how Mayo Clinic is leading the way in the field of precision medicine. Plus, the stars of A Lesson Before Dying at Players by the Sea. All of that and more ahead. But first, this morning, he's a noted author and the founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Alabama-based nonprofit that has been instrumental in raising awareness over the years about civil rights issues, domestic terrorism, and racially motivated hate crimes. And he's a nationally recognized advocate for civil rights and tolerance. Morris Dees will speak on the UNF campus this month. He's on the line now with a preview of his talk. It's titled, With Justice for All in a Changing America. Morris Dees, a pleasure. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning to you. Thank you.
Great to have you on the show. And what are your questions for Morris Dees, founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or email and tweet the show. Just go to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Morris, in reading about your background, it's fascinating to learn that you actually were the son of Alabama cotton farmers and you grew up in the Jim Crow era. Can you tell me a little bit about how that affected your decision to found the Southern Poverty Law Center, your upbringing?
Well, I grew up on a cotton farm. We didn't own any land, so we rented from the other white farmers, and I had to get in the fields and work alongside black people, and I saw how horrible they were treated. I did have an opportunity to go to college and law school, and when I got out of college, the people who came to see me, legal counsel, were pretty much the friends I grew up with. One came in wanting to be a state trooper. Alabama troopers just beat up the marchers at the Selma Bridge. 650 white troopers in the trooper force, no blacks. I represented Philip Paradise and got him the right to be a state trooper, and that kind of began it. It wasn't anything I planned to do. I didn't plan to be a civil rights lawyer. I just wanted to make a living practicing law, but it turned out that the cases that came to me gave me an opportunity to take a stand for my friends.
And, of course, the Southern Poverty Law Center has been around since the early 70s. What were your thoughts with the release of the film Selma? And just a week or two ago, there was an event in Selma, a symbolic march to celebrate the film across that same Edmund Pettus Bridge. What were your thoughts when you saw that?
Well, first of all, my thoughts are that hopefully that march and that beating of the people who were trying to seek the right to vote was the last battle in the American Revolution. In that revolution, we had to free ourselves and gain freedom for our people. Omitted African Americans, even count them as 3/4 of a person. Our Supreme Court said a black person was property in a Dred versus Scott decision. So I think it's an important event in our history and certainly needs celebrating. I guess the film bothered me because there's some effort to make Lyndon Johnson look like a racist, and he certainly was anything but that with the Voting Rights Act, and he did a wonderful, wonderful thing in working with King, not against him. On the other hand, the Southern Poverty Law Center just released a film called Selma, The Bridge to the Right to Vote. It's a film that shows the role of young people as part of our Teaching Tolerance program. It'll be distributed to over 80,000 schools in America. It's a classroom-length 40-minute film. I think it tells the story probably better than the movie Selma because it gives everybody their due, the children who marched and were arrested, along with the local people.
Now, the topic of your talk on the UNF campus is With Justice for All in a Changing America. How do you see the role of the Southern Poverty Law Center in 21st century America?
Well, the issues are certainly changing because of the major demographic changes in our country. When I grew up on a cotton farm in the 40s, only about 15% of our population was people of color. Today, it's 37%. And by the year 2040, people, whites like myself, will be in a minority. Not to say there's anything wrong with that. America's great because of our diversity. People came from everywhere. But it changes the issues. And also, we've had some social changes. Rights for women, LGBT rights. We're fighting a big battle now with the in Alabama to gain the right for LGBT people to get married. And also we have a great influx of immigrants in our country today. Mainly Latinos. Had they all pulled out and left this country, we'd be in real trouble because they do so many important jobs. President Reagan made so that some 4 or 5 million could gain green card status, and now Obama tries basically the same thing, and everybody's against it. So I think we're going to have a whole new attitude about our immigrants in this nation. And we've got to come up with a comprehensive immigration bill that allows people a route to citizenship.
We're speaking right now with Morris Dees, attorney and founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Let's get a few callers on the air. The number to join us, 549-2937. Jay in Tampa. Go ahead, Jay.
Good morning. If I'm not mistaken, the SPLC has a map that shows the number of hate groups that are active across the country. And in Florida in particular, Duval County has the most hate groups in the state. I would like Mr. Dees to talk about what does racism and hate look like now compared to what it looked like when during the civil rights movement of the 60s.
Thanks for that question. Morris Dees, your organization tracks hate groups, and especially racially motivated ones. What about that question?
Well, I didn't hear Jay's full question, but would you tell me what his question was?
Sure. He said that the SPLC tracks hate groups, and in particular, he wanted to know about the growth in these groups in recent years, and especially in our part of Florida.
Well, it's a good question, Jay. Since Obama was president, we've seen a doubling of the number of militia groups, so-called militia groups, various kind of governmental anti-government groups, as well as your traditional hate groups. In Florida certainly has its share per capita, probably along with the other states. The largest ones are California and some in the southeastern states. We file lawsuits that have put the major hate groups out of business, the groups that bomb the church, that kill the four girls in Birmingham. But I think the increase in these number of anti-government militia-type groups is a reflection of this changing America. There are people who feel like that these things that other people are getting are things that belong to them, they're privileged, and they should have these things, and you shouldn't have to give everybody else an equal opportunity. And also, we've got a lot of anti-Muslim sentiment in this country today, but we've seen, you know, Sikhs murdered and killed because of the headwear, because, you know, some of these hate groups, especially ones that in Milwaukee that killed the seven or eight Sikhs in one shooting, he thought they were Muslims. He didn't know the difference. He hates anything that doesn't look like him.
Emmett's on the line from Jacksonville. Go ahead, Emmett. You're on the air.
Yes, yes. My question is concerning the four big words that I think Martin Luther King spoke of was, it's up to us. And one of the things that I see that's going on is that the skills level of our young people, what are we doing about making sure our kids have a good skill coming out of high school? That's what I'm interested in. I think that's the role of civil rights going forward. Our kids must have a skill coming out of high school.
Yeah, thanks, Emmett, for that call. And so, Morris Dees, Emmett wanting to know, and of course, you did name your organization the Southern Poverty Law Center. Emmett asking, how can we better prepare the next generation for good careers and for middle-class income?
Well, Emmett asked a really important question, and that is the bottom line is going to be educating our population and prepare them for a digital world we live in, the world where some of the manual labor that's been conducted in the past won't be, and people to make a good living are going to have to join the generation of the Internet. And we've got to get broadband Internet scattered all over this country, rural areas where no child does not have access. When I grew up, the World Book Encyclopedia was every house had one if you had any money at all. But today, if you don't have the Internet and research, young people are left behind. The income gap in this country has grown wider between the poor and the wealthy, and that's tragic. If we had inflation-adjusted minimum wage, the minimum wage would be a little over $15 an hour. And those are issues we're going to have to confront. they're not as simple as the blacks are forced to ride on the back of the bus. They're not that simple. They're much more complicated than that. Now that we have Republican control of the House and Senate, I'm not sure how much we're going to gain because of the strident kind of attitude they've had towards things like health care for our people.
Here's a question coming in from Dave on Twitter. What can young lawyers do to move the SPL Center cause forward?
Dave, young lawyers can get involved in their community. They can go to areas where the age, the handicapped, people have housing issues, poor people seeking health care, immigrants trying to figure out how to deal with some of the laws that affect their lives. There's so many ways that young lawyers, even though they work in corporate law firms, which some of them have to, nothing wrong with that, corporations need good lawyers, to make to pay their debts and going to law school, but they can volunteer their services, ACLU, the NAACP, and there's so many nonprofit groups that need lawyers, women's rights, minority rights, children's rights, old people rights, people who have emotional handicap issues.
Right. Our own legal aid in Jacksonville can always use help. And so it's really a pleasure to have you on the phone. Morris Dees, founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center, thanks for joining the show this morning.
You're more than welcome. Thank you, Lavelle.
Morris Dees will discuss With Justice for All in a Changing America the evening of Thursday, February 19th at UNF's University Center. Go to unf.edu/lectures for more information on his talk. Much more still ahead on this show later. It's a journey back to the Jim Crow era that we were just speaking about as we talk with the stars of A Lesson Before Dying on stage this weekend at Players by the Sea. But up next, how Jacksonville's Mayo Clinic is leading the way in the field of precision medicine. That's in a moment.
From the moment you wake up, through the chaos of your busy morning, Morning Edition is there with you.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Protesters have been
through all you have to do, we'll bring you all you need to know tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings starting at 5 on 89.9.
WJCTNews.org is your source for the latest local, national, and international news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Podcasts of your favorite local stories and shows, the WJCT First Read every weekday morning, and playlists from all of our after-hours music programming. From your computer or mobile device, see it all at WJCTNews.org.
With same-sex marriage legal in Florida, advocates are celebrating civil rights victories. In WJCT's StoryCorps Out Loud series, we take a look back at Jacksonville's gay rights history with stories from the local LGBT youth support group, Jasmine.
I had never heard the term trans.
My mother, I think she went to bed every night praying that I would be heterosexual.
StoryCorps Out Loud is Thursdays during Morning Edition on WJCT.
Listen to After Hours to relax with music that spans the world in all styles from classical to doo-wop. Weeknights at 7, only on 89.9 FM.
Welcome back. Well, it's a growing trend in the medical field. Precision medicine, also known as individualized medicine or personalized medicine. The idea is that the doctor uses knowledge about a patient's genetic makeup to help determine the best plan for disease prevention, diagnosis, and treatment. The mapping of the human genome in 2003 really jump-started this process. And a couple of years ago, Mayo Clinic identified precision medicine as the future of medical treatment. Now the federal government is also recognizing precision medicine as the best way to treat the patient. President Obama even referenced precision medicine in his recent State of the Union address. What's this all about? Well, with more, we welcome Dr. Alexander Parker, Associate Director of the Mayo Clinic Center for Individualized Medicine. Dr. Parker, good morning.
Good morning.
And if you have questions about precision medicine, how your genes are driving medical treatments, give us a call, 549-2937. So during that State of the Union address, it was the first time probably in such an address that a president made a call for a national initiative to advance the cause of individualized medicine. That caught a lot of people's attention.
Yes, it did, and it should have, because this is an exciting new time in medicine. We are able to leverage new technologies, particularly in genetics and genomics, that are allowing us to go to the patient bedside and get answers that are more specific to a patient's individual needs about their health and wellness than ever before. And really, let's be honest, that's what we want when we go to the doctor. We don't want to know how you're going to treat kidney cancer. We want to know how you're going to treat my kidney cancer.
Exactly. So how did the mapping of the human genome help facilitate the growth of this field?
So we've had kind of this long love story with DNA. We've known for a long time that the answers to a lot of our questions about why we get disease and how we respond to different treatments are there in our DNA. The problem was before we were forced to look at little tiny pieces one at a time and hope that that's where we could find the answer. Now, with these new sequencing technologies that allow us to look at the entire complement of information that's in your DNA at one time, we don't have to guess where the answer might be. We can go find where the answer is.
And that's what happens at the Mayo Clinic Center for Individualized Medicine. A couple of years ago, Mayo made this a priority, correct?
Yes, 100%. We decided that it was time. And we got together and said, there is value in bringing this technology to the patient bedside. We don't want to do things just because they're cool or neat. We want to do them when we keep the needs of the patient at the center of what we're doing. And we decided in 2013 there were two areas where we could bring this to the patient bedside to help. Advanced cancers, people that have failed standard therapies, we can use this technology to try to find new clues to how to treat their cancer. And the other is diagnostic odysseys. These are people that have had a disease that no one's been able to put a finger on exactly what it is, but run batteries of tests, been all over the world, can't find an answer. They are coming to Mayo Clinic. And through the power of genomic sequencing, we are finding answers for these patients.
In fact, there was a fascinating case published in the Florida Times Union about a patient named Dustin Bennett who had that issue. He'd been tested and looked at, and nobody could figure out what was wrong. When he came to the Center for Individualized Medicine, you found that he had a very rare genetic mutation that caused his illness. And you were able to figure out a treatment plan based on that.
Yes, the Bennett family story is the absolute home run story across the board. Dustin's family had taken him all over the world looking for answers to his question. No one could. Batteries of tests were run, a lot of times repeated, and run at the same, same tests run at different institutions. He came to Mayo Clinic, and our team, Dr. Zolik, his neurologist, Kim Guthrie, the genetic counselor, myself, Doug Rieger-Johnson, our medical geneticist, got together and said, there's value in using this technology to try to help him find an answer. And sure enough, through genomic sequencing, we were able to find what was causing his disease, which, first of all, let's imagine that. You've been someone that's lived with a disease your entire life.
And don't know what it is.
Don't know what it is. No one can tell you what it is. First of all, it's very, very comforting to at least know this is why I have what I have.
Sure.
But for us, the home run was it also led to a treatment that when he started has been controlling his symptoms and giving him back his quality of life.
How are you treating him?
He's actually taking a drug called acetazolamide, which is, again, a standard treatment for someone with episodic ataxia type 1, which is what he has, but no one had been able to diagnose that. And again, it's important to underscore that there were no single gene tests that would have allowed us to test for this. It was because we did whole genome sequencing. Again, not looking at pieces, but looking at the entire complement, that we were able to find the cause and treat his disease.
It's a fascinating medical topic right now. As we look at the ways the mapping of the human genome has sparked explosive growth in the field of precision medicine or individualized medicine, looking at your specific genetic makeup to figure out how to treat what ails you, what are your questions for Dr. Parker of Mayo Clinic? 549-2937. Henry on the north side. Go ahead, Henry.
Yes, Dr. Parker, thank you for the opportunity to ask you a couple of questions. First of all, I want to find out what the outlook is for medical technical availability to the less fortunate, particularly since many people obviously cannot afford the procedure that you have to go through to get to Mayo Clinic. That's number one. And the other one is the legal complications, especially with the insurance companies paying for this type of treatment. Thank you.
Yeah, two excellent questions. Thanks, Henry, for the call.
Yes, two very excellent questions, and I'm glad this gives us a chance to underscore here. This is exciting new technology, and right now we're at the peripheries of medicine. Advanced cancers, diagnostic odysseys. We do see this one day becoming as routine as routine lab work or x-rays. It will make it there. But his questions specifically are about the cost. Right now, the cost, we can sequence human genomes. We can do it very quickly. The analysis still takes some time. So we're still talking about a cost that is going to be difficult for some patients to pay for. So we're working with insurance companies to show value in this, to prove that by doing this, let's go back to the Bennett story, to prove that rather than spending 20 years running multiple tests, one test could have been run that would have found the answer precisely and quickly. So again, we want to work with insurance companies and other payers to make sure that they understand that this is something we need to bring to everyone. It's not something that should be provided to a small sect of the population. It should be available to everyone.
You've also signed up thousands of volunteers to donate genetic material to be used in research, correct?
Oh, this is correct. Now, you've asked the question that I'm most excited about because I'm a researcher at heart.
Uh-huh.
And research takes a long time. We lovingly call it a marathon, not a sprint. And through what you've referred to, the Mayo Clinic Biobank is one of the ways we're trying to accelerate that pace by having people provide us with access to a blood sample, their medical record. They fill out extensive questionnaires. So what we're creating is a warehouse that researchers can go to get a jump start when they have a question, something that they want to move quickly on. This is a way to accelerate that pace because we can't take to the clinic what we don't know.
Mm-hmm. In the meantime, President Obama is asking Congress for $70 million for genome research on cancer, $130 million for a national biobank, similar to what you're creating at Mayo.
Yes, exactly.
Politically, in these times, it's hard to get funding for every project that's on a president's wish list, of course, whichever party's in power. What about the politics of funding this type of research?
Well, the way I'd like to put it is there should be, and currently there aren't any politics behind this. Disease doesn't understand political affiliations. It doesn't understand religious affiliations. It's disease, and we all suffer from it. So right now, one of the most promising things that I'm seeing is that this is getting bipartisan support, that precision medicine, people are realizing that this isn't a political issue. This is an issue about our health and our wellness, and we want to be driving this into the clinics and into our preventive strategies and public health to make a difference for people. And I'm really excited to see that people are not using party lines to try to slow something like this down.
And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about precision medicine, how the mapping of the human genome has opened up a new field of study, looking at your genes to study and treat you when you're sick. 549-2937. John in Jacksonville. Go ahead, John. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is anyone looking at the genome to maybe find a cure for the Alzheimer's? Is it possible that that's something connected with dreams? A person's mind gets locked in a dream mode if they're looking for scenarios like that.
John, thanks for the call.
Yeah, thanks, John. Good question. So first of all, it's a good chance to highlight that at Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, we have some of the international leaders in Alzheimer's research.
Uh-huh.
And right now, we are leveraging genomic technology to really help them bring forward their understanding of the genetic mutations that put us at risk of Alzheimer's. Now, right now, I'm sad to say that we don't really think right now what we know is going to inform any treatment. But first of all, being able to help people understand their risk of developing Alzheimer's, now we can start looking at maybe early prevention, things that could delay the onset. I wish I could tell John right now that we were already fast on a cure, but we'll get there. Well, I promise we'll get there.
You said right now that the field of study involves cancer and mysterious conditions, but I would think down the road, the possibilities for this type of research are limitless. There are so many conditions that I'm sure you hope can be treated this way.
Oh, 100%. Again, from the research standpoint, we've been over the moon for a few years because the studies we can design now to find the causes of disease and look at things of why people respond to certain treatments are just It's mind blowing what we can do. But at the clinic side, again, right now it's kind of at the peripheries. One area that I haven't had a chance to mention is the area of pharmacogenomics, which is a big part of individualized medicine. We all know when we take medications that we can respond differently to them. I like to use the example when I take a Tylenol PM, it knocks me out. You'd have to wake me up 3 days later.
Right.
But my own family member, my brother, can take it and has no effect on him. So clearly we all process drugs differently, and we know that the answer to that is in our genes. We are now using that information at Mayo Clinic to help get patients the right drug at the right time.
Let me ask you this too. In an era of managed care, when it's doctors and patients are so frustrated with the lack of personal attention, doctors have to push so many patients through their doors every day, booking all these different appointments just because of the funding mechanism of the healthcare system. How can personalized medicine fit into that world where each patient's really getting a lot of personal study and attention?
Well, you've hit on another really great part of all of this is that we really have to advance education, not just for our physicians about the transformative power of genomics, but we really want to start educating patients. This is a chance for people to really take an even bigger role in their own health. And we want to educate patients about how they can understand the information that we're bringing back so that they can have a better conversation with their physician. And again, I completely understand your point. Time's limited and people are being moved through very quickly. How do you, in that context, bring in more information like this? Well, it's going to have to be through education, having people understand the type of data that we're generating and having them take control in their own autonomy.
Matt in downtown Jacksonville. Go ahead, Matt.
Hey, just had a couple of questions. I suffer from IBD, and that's like an inflammatory disease, but mainly it's because of the autoimmune system. And I was just thinking the other day, you know, I'm European, and I know that a lot of people who have like UC or any kind of clones or anything like that have European descent in them, and I was just wondering if there's anyone's ever done research on people who survived the Black Plague because maybe they have an overactive immune system. I know that sounds far-fetched, but, you know, you're a genome doctor, so I just thought of that.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. Interesting.
Matt, you're talking to the right guy. Nothing's ever far-fetched to me. First of all, I just say this is a good chance to underscore that while we're excited about being able to explore the genetic causes of disease, this is only a part of what keeps us healthy. And your immune system is also another part. And actually, your immune system is controlled by genetics as well. But Matt brings up a good point that there's going to be a lot of other avenues that we need to make sure we continue to explore to help understand health and human wellness. You've given me a good idea about it. I'm an epidemiologist at heart, so your question is right in line with how I think of maybe there was some sort of selective pressure from the Black Plague. I'll have to get back to you on that. But it's good to underscore that, you know, this is exciting. This is transformative. It is changing the way we practice medicine. But there's always going to be a need, first of all, for people to take control of their own health and wellness. Don't smoke. Try to eat a balanced diet, exercise, you know.
Sure.
We want to be sure we underscore that, too.
Catherine in Jacksonville. Go ahead, Catherine. Thanks for holding.
Hi. This is a very interesting topic, and I listen to your radio every morning.
Thanks.
I have a immune disease. It's called EBA, and I've been having it since 2007. I have a specialist I go to in Gainesville. It's a immune disease and it affected my skin a couple of years ago. I'm still going through treatment. I would like to know, can you tell me how I cannot give you my comment, get you information for you to be able to do research on this disease?
Catherine, thanks for calling. Dr. Parker.
Sure, Catherine. I understand your situation, and I'm sorry to hear that you're still struggling with this. As far as supporting research into this area, a great way to be able to participate is to go back to what we were talking about earlier about the biobank. Participants in this biobank, we're not focusing on any one disease. We're looking at a cross-section of everybody we see at Mayo Clinic. And therefore, we get a chance to provide samples across a wide variety of conditions, everything from the very common conditions like hypertension, diabetes, heart disease, out to the more rare conditions like the one you described. So again, the biobank would be one way that we're sort of advancing that.
Sure. Fascinating topic and certainly a lot of interest. Thanks so much, Doctor, for joining us with more about it.
Yeah, thanks so much.
We were joined by Dr. Alexander Parker, Associate Director of the Mayo Clinic Center for Individualized Medicine. Back in a moment.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, Reveal.
The first thing we knew is that this story is going to be about people trying to keep secrets.
Tracking down what one powerful religious hierarchy was keeping under wraps.
How come we didn't hear about the seriousness of his past, you know?
Find out on the next Reveal. There's always more to the story. Saturday at 3 on 89.9 WJCT. Chances are you remember where you were when prosecutors released the verdicts about Michael Brown and Eric Gardner. When grand juries cleared police of wrongdoing in their deaths, the nation responded with protests, finger-pointing, and questions. I'm State of the Reunion host Al Letson. Join WJCT for an open and honest discussion that brings issues of race and justice to the forefront with the hopes of understanding and change. Race in the River City, February 12th at 8 on WJCT Public Television.
Hi, I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
And we're the guys from Deemable Tech.
Hey, if you've got a question about your computer, mobile phone, tablet, or the internet...
And who doesn't?
We're here to help.
Join us Thursdays during Morning Edition and All Things Considered here on WJCT.
And check out our podcast online at deemable.com.
That's deemable.com.
Welcome back. Well, the First Coast is rapidly becoming a hub for alternative fuels, especially when it comes to transportation and businesses' fleets. The North Florida Transportation Planning Organization, or the TPO, is leading the way in providing opportunities and funding to advance the adoption of alternative fuels for business. The 2015 AFV Expo is going to highlight fleet conversion success stories and funding options for alternative fuel vehicles and infrastructure. This expo is coming up on the 19th, and it's the topic of today's Going Green. Jeff Sheffield, Executive Director of the North Florida TPO, is here now with a preview. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning.
This is exciting stuff. We hear a lot of talk about the need to pursue alternatives. You guys are putting this into action with really good information, success stories, funding mechanisms. What else is going to be happening? This is the AFV Expo. That's Alternative Fuel Vehicle Expo. Exciting to share this news.
Yeah, it's a good opportunity. It's the third time that we've had the chance to do this event. We have really been working in the area of alternative fuels now since about 2009, trying to leverage opportunities in the region. This expo that we do at UNF on the 19th is just an opportunity to really bring together anybody interested in all fuel vehicles. The last couple of years, the mission of the event has really been for providers to come in and speak to the community and businesses and let them understand more about alternative fuel vehicles. But we've seen so much success even in the last year with businesses starting to convert to alt fuels. This particular event will actually flip that. And we're going to have the businesses come in now and share their successes already and why they are doing this.
Very nice. In particular, one company, Champion Brands, will share their perspective. How has Champion Brands made this type of conversion?
It's really been something that they have been contemplating. Earl Benton, their president and CEO there for Champion, has been contemplating it for a number of years. But now the business model works. And so they have, as of last week, opened their compressed natural gas station. And he is running now Champion trucks on compressed natural gas. But I think more important from the TPO's perspective is that he recognized the value of being part of a regional network of fueling. So his facility is actually open to public access. So he's also fueling other trucks from other companies.
How much demand is there?
There's a growing demand. Obviously, we've already, again, with the kind of network that we've been developing with an Alt Fuels Coalition, there was already an awareness of fleets from out of the city coming into Jacksonville. And so we knew there was an opportunity. For example, in Earl's case with Champion, Saddle Creek Logistics out in Lakeland, Florida, runs about 15 trucks or more here in Jacksonville and had no opportunities for fueling. So now we've had the opportunity to connect those two, and they now are fueling, and that's what they did, in fact, last week.
That's terrific. I mean, the North Florida TPO has always had the role of taking a big picture look at our transportation needs, our infrastructure. You do a lot of long-range planning. Mm-hmm. How does the growth of alternative fuels fit into your infrastructure, your long-range plan for the region?
Well, we've developed as well an alt-fuels master plan. And I think for us, we're just recognizing again on the transportation perspective that this is another means to help grow this region, particularly from an economic perspective. Alt-fuels now, the business model works for fleets. It provides an opportunity for additional cost savings to those industries and therefore opportunity for growth. So we see that as an opportunity for us. And our board has recognized that as we've been able to allocate funds now to help with that conversion. Just in the last couple of years now, we've been able to dedicate about $4.6 million to various mm-hmm. initiatives. So we're helping county fleets convert their vehicles. We're working with the private sector as well in rail and other opportunities. And we've also are a partner with JTA with their compressed natural gas and providing some funding to them.
Excellent. Now, when people come out to this expo, they'll be able to look at these vehicles, whether they're powered by natural gas or electricity, the two most common types of alternative fuels, right?
That's correct. There's a lot of vehicles out there, a little bit of everything from pickup trucks to school buses running propane to Teslas and other sports car opportunities out there, as well as BMW, Ford, and Chevy will have a number of vehicles. So a lot of opportunity to see the vehicles, both electric, propane, and compressed natural gas. And really, you're right. Electric is something that's out there as well. We talk about natural gas, and that's really something more geared towards fleets. The electric vehicle is really another opportunity more for the consumer, the everyday user. And so we're very pleased, in fact, to be able to partner right now in an initiative with JEA. In fact, just last week, we went live with an application opportunity now. The TPO has seeded funds for investing and installing EV charging units all over the region. Mm-hmm. JEA has stepped up with us as a partner and is providing that process. We'll administer the program, and we will look to deploy them throughout the region.
Right now, there are only a few, but the idea, isn't it, Jeff, to have them really not as common as a gas station on every corner maybe, but many more of them so that if someone does want to buy an electric car, they'll have more choices in terms of where to stop and recharge it.
That is true. I think this is one of those areas in particular where you do build it and they will come.
Uh-huh.
When we listen to the EV community and those interested in buying, and we listen to the dealers of vehicles, it is a term called range anxiety. So what's turning a lot of people away from buying them is this notion that you will run out of electricity and cannot
stuck.
Charge.
Yeah.
And so we believe that through this initiative with JEA, the ability to deploy a network of EV stations throughout the region eliminates that anxiety. We're already sensing that as we talk to the dealers now. When they know that this network is coming, there's a greater willingness for them to provide those vehicles on their lots now for purchase.
What's the timetable for that, and how can people find out where the charging stations will be?
The charging stations and their locations, this is in fact an application process. So those businesses or locations actually interested in locating one of these units can go through the application process. So we've identified a few key locations. The remainder of the funding is for people who are interested in having them. So restaurants and other businesses can submit, and we will go through that process. So we're really talking about probably over the next 60 to 90 days, the application process is there. So they can go to the JEA's website, mm-hmm. or they can go to the North Florida TPO website and get a link to that. We will be really unveiling that initiative at February 19th Expo event at UNF. But we'll see how that first phase goes. It is our goal, once we've done this initial rollout with JEA, to seed additional funds to move beyond just the JEA service area and reach further into Clay, St. John's, and Nassau County.
Pretty exciting. So check that out. And in the meantime, mark your calendars for the expo, the AFV Expo, coming up February 19th at the University Center on the UNF campus. And you had one more mention.
One mention. It is a free event, so please come. But we would ask, if you don't mind, if you plan on coming, please go to the North Florida TPO website and register, though. We do want to maintain a log. We've seen continued growth over the last couple of years, and so we just want to make sure we kind of understand who's there.
Sure. It's northfloridatpo.com to register for the expo and also to find out about how to apply to have an EV charging station at your location. Jeff Sheffield, Executive Director of the North Florida TPO. Fascinating stuff. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back.
This Going Green segment brought to you by Bug Out Service.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, recent sophisticated and large-scale cyber attacks are prompting sharp policy debate on appropriate counterattack strategies, the growing risks posed by cybersecurity attacks. Weekdays at 10, right after First Coast Connect on 89.9 FM WJCT.
David Axelrod has been called everything from President Obama's message maven to a lefty lumberjack. On the next Fresh Air, he tells us about shaping media strategy for two presidential campaigns and shares some moments from his years at the Obama White House, including one when the president called him an unrepeatable expletive. Axelrod has a new memoir. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Hi, I'm Warren Miller. Each week on Closing the Loop, we hear stories of how North Floridians are dealing with change, the recession and sluggish recovery, events in their families, their own health, and their career changes. Closing the Loop is personal, often surprising, and every week it reflects the resilience of the human spirit. Join me each Friday here on WJCT for Closing the Loop.
Join us weeknights at 7 for music. From symphonies to the latest indie music, you'll hear it all weeknights at 7, only on 89.9 FM.
Deep below the sea, darling, on deep blue sea. Deep below the sea, darling.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, picture the year 1948 in a small plantation community deep in the heart of Cajun country. An innocent black man is found guilty of murder and sentenced to death. This disturbing injustice is the springboard for spiritual growth and redemption in Romulus Linney's uplifting drama, A Lesson Before Dying. It's a beautiful adaptation of Ernest Gaines's highly praised novel. Players by the Sea will debut this production this weekend. Larry Knight, who plays Grant, and Tony Phillips, who plays Miss Emma, are here now in studio with more about the show. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You know, it was interesting at the top of the hour to speak with Morris Dees, the founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Of course, he founded that organization growing up in the Jim Crow South. This production is set in the Jim Crow South. For those that aren't familiar with the story, Larry, can you give us a preview of what people will enjoy when they come out to see the play?
Sure. It's a beautiful elegiac piece where you have a character, Jefferson, who is on death row for having committed a crime, well, for being accused of committing a crime that he did not commit. And because of the demographics and the dynamics of the community at that time, he has no voice, and he's essentially there to serve as a representative of all the people who are not given a voice. And Grant Wiggins, my character, is a teacher who is put into service by Miss Emma, and he's instructed to teach him how to be a man at this pivotal moment in the last moments of his life. And Tony is such a phenomenal actress, and she really brings Miss Emma to life, and she just imbues her with all of the spirituality and the emotion, and all of the other members of the cast, like, really bring these characters to life in such a way where, it is clearly going to be an emotional event for all those who are have opportunity to see it.
How is it for you, Tony, portraying this character? As he said, it's pretty serious, heavy subject matter.
It is, but it's, if you've had powerful women in your life, if you've grown up around women, I mean, I think of my mom when during some of Miss Emma's prayers and her going to God and the way that she leans on the Reverend Ambrose for support and for strength. And when you've seen that, and when you've seen how real it is, you appreciate Miss Emma, because this is a hopeless situation. There is no way to prevent this young man's death. However, he doesn't have to die as he sees himself as a hog, as he's been called. He can see himself, and this is her whole purpose in life during this, is to make sure that he dies a man. I mean, we can't stop this from happening, but we can change how it happens to you and how it is seen by the world.
The arts as well, I think, were so powerful in dramatizing the horrors of the racist Jim Crow South in a way that, people talk about hearts and minds. Plays like A Lesson Before Dying, books, and then the film To Kill a Mockingbird. They really helped people see and understand the injustice that was happening. How do you see the arts fulfilling that role when it comes to social justice and bringing about social change?
Well, I think that the arts clearly imitate life to some degree, and I think that we use it as a vehicle to discuss some of the most uncomfortable things that happen in the world that we live in. So I think that with this particular play, it's easy for us to look at it and see traces of what we're experiencing now in 21st century America. And I think that the arts gives us an inroads to looking at some very uncomfortable aspects of our history, but also understanding where we are as a culture, as a community, as a society.
Right. All these themes are still relevant in some respects today.
They really are. It's hard to sometimes look at the news or to see things happening in your actual life and understand truly the impact of them. But if you crystallize it into the plot of a play or the plot of a movie, and you have characters that you're allowed to fall in love with to some degree and then see what happens to them, somehow that makes it more personal, and it makes it so that you can actually see better the things that are going on around you.
Yeah, and there are certain pivotal characters that when people can identify with that character, mm-hmm. all of a sudden an abstract issue becomes real for them. It's really transformative. And so A Lesson Before Dying kicks off Valentine's Day weekend, but runs through February. So
yes.
People have opportunities to come out and see it, right?
Absolutely.
They do, and we want them to come. And with the warning that they should bring some tissues or a hanky, I know it's emotional for us.
Absolutely. So.
Yeah, for both of you.
Yes, it is. Powerful.
Incredibly powerful and beautiful. It's beautiful in the story, terrible, but incredibly beautiful.
Well, your two major talents, and we so appreciate you sharing a little bit of it with us on the air this morning. So thanks for being here and break a leg in the show.
Thank you.
Actors Larry Knight and Tony Phillips, stars of A Lesson Before Dying, Players by the Sea, is putting on this production, and it kicks off Friday, February 13th, runs through the month. Get your tickets at playersbythesea.org. And that's our program. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks to all of our guests and callers today. The show's producer is Sean Birch. Our show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. If you've got feedback or comments about something you heard, just send us an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to catch our daily podcast. It's now up on iTunes. Next on Die and Ream, recent sophisticated and large-scale cyber attacks are prompting sharp policy debate on appropriate counterattack strategies. Debate over what steps can be taken to reduce the threat of cyber attacks. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.